Today on the 21st, we're bringing you some of our favorite author interviews from this year, including our conversation with Chicago-based writer Christy Tate. Her debut memoir is Group: How One Therapist and a Circle of Strangers Saved My Life.
All the mess and all my dirty laundry was in their hands, and they continued to support me and love me, and that was radical.
Then an interview with Eric Weiner, a former NPR foreign correspondent and author of The Socrates Express, in search of life lessons from dead philosophers. And we'll explore the far-flung place names you can find right here in Illinois. What's the story behind Paris, Versailles, and Cairo? Not Cairo, thank you. I'm Brian Mackey. That's all coming up today on the 21st, which is a production of Illinois Public Media, airing on WILL in Urbana, WUIS in Springfield, WGLT in Normal, WCBU in Peoria, and WNIJ in DeKalb. But first, the news. From Illinois Public Media, this is The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. Today, we're bringing you some of our favorite conversations with authors from this year. Later this hour, we'll hear from former NPR correspondent Eric Weiner about his book, The Socrates Express, in search of life lessons from dead philosophers. And we'll talk to an Illinoisan who began as a Frenchman and turned his fascination with Illinois place names into a new book about the backstories of towns like Paris, Norway, and Savoy. But first, back in October, we spoke with Chicago-based writer Christy Tate. Her debut memoir is Group: How One Therapist and a Circle of Strangers Saved My Life. It traces the highs and lows of her mental health journey. Some time ago, Tate had just graduated number one in her class at law school, and from the outside looking in, life was good. But the truth was, she was grappling with a number of issues within, issues that brought her frighteningly close to the brink. She ultimately found restoration through group therapy. Tate's writing has been published in the Washington Post, in the New York Times Modern Love column, and in The Rumpus. Her memoir came out in October, and that's when we spoke with her on the 21st. Here now is our interview with Christy Tate. Hello, Christy. Welcome to the 21st.
Thank you for having me.
And listeners, we do want to prepare you that this book and this conversation is going to touch on some sensitive topics pertaining to mental health. And just say, if you or someone you know is in need of help, you can contact the National Crisis Text Line, which provides free and confidential crisis intervention. Just text the word HOME to 741-741. That's HOME to 741-741. So, Christy, in the opening pages of your book, you set the scene, right? I mentioned it a moment ago. You just graduated at the top of your class in law school. You're driving through Chicago and fantasizing about your own death. When did you know you needed help, and what made you seek out group therapy?
Well, I think that I knew I was headed for trouble years before I actually reached out to Dr. Rosen and got into group therapy. I kept thinking that I could work my way out of the funk that I felt. And really, how I would describe it is I was really lonely. I was really isolated. I felt far apart from other people, and I didn't have intimate relationships, even though I desperately longed for them. And I just hid out in school, and I went to law school precisely because I knew my personal relationships were really dismal and I wasn't good at them. So I thought, well, I'll just take all my energy, I'll pour it into a career, and then I'll at least have that. But then right at the beginning of the book, that scene, I'm driving down Clybourne in Chicago, and I thought, I just want to die. I hope someone shoots me. And that was something beyond malaise. It really scared me. What was so startling to me was I had just the week before gone to the bursar's office where I went to law school in Chicago, and they handed me a card with my class rank on it. And it said 1 out of 171 students. And I did have a moment of elation, and I could recognize that was an incredible accomplishment. I was going to have a wonderful professional future. But inside, I couldn't sustain any feeling of joy because I knew I'd picked the whole legal enterprise because of personal failures. And I'm driving with a bag of fruit and vegetables from Stanley's, and I'm I'm eating a plum, and I just thought, I hope I die. And I that just can't be right. I can't be this poised for this amount of professional success while also hoping somebody shoots me. That disconnect was so startling. And you know, I went back to my apartment and I didn't have anybody to call. And it was, you know, when you're single and lonely and there's a holiday weekend when you imagine everybody else is on a boat or at a barbecue and I didn't have anywhere to be, it felt like the end. Like, this is the end if something drastic doesn't happen.
Yeah. So you end up finding a therapist, and you write that your therapist, Dr. Rosen, issued a 9-word prescription that would help you navigate through some of the crises or feelings you were experiencing. Can you share that and how it was meaningful to you?
Sure. So I went into therapy thinking, okay, I'm going to pay the big bucks and I'm going to have this therapist. And he first tells me, well, I work in groups and everything you want from therapy, which really boiled down to relationships, he said the only way to get there is through group. And I said, okay, fine. But there was a part of me that wanted essentially a quick fix. I wanted a cure. And I would go to sessions early on and things would happen. Like, he would offer me a suggestion about how to balance my studies and not study for 12 hours straight. And I would say, will this cure me? Will this cure me? And at one point, probably in the first 3 months, he said to me, you don't need a cure. You need a witness. And what he was offering and what I came to understand was there are no cures. There weren't for me and for what I was going through, but having witnesses meant I could, number one, disclose all the things, the secrets, the habits, all the shame I was holding for years and years and years. I could disclose that to a group of witnesses, my group, and I could let go of shame and I could learn some skills and I could have all this company and these witnesses so I could stop walking the earth thinking, I'm disgusting. Nobody knows me. If they knew, that all went away because now there was a group of people who knew all the mess and all my dirty laundry was in their hands and they continued to support me and love me. And that was radical.
The 9-word prescription, can you say, I mean, what specifically that was?
The 9-word prescription was, you don't need a cure, you need a witness.
Yeah, okay. So talk about then the witness aspect, right? Group therapy, for people maybe who haven't been through it. Like, you're sitting in a circle with a bunch of strangers. I mean, just physically, what is this experience like in the room?
Yeah, people are really curious. And I had no idea until I finally started talking to people about group therapy that people just don't know this. And so the way that ours works is we sit in a circle, we all have the same kind of chair, the room is slightly bigger than the circle. So it's like a 14x14 room. And the therapist in my situation, Dr. Rosen, always sits in the same seat. And the rest of us sort of move around, like you don't have an assigned chair. And the sessions are 90 minutes. And you don't get called on, nobody forces you to talk. But at the same time, the skills that you learn in group therapy include learning how to speak up for yourself and taking up space when other people are talking and offering your insight to other people. And what I love about this witness, the witness component is I don't have to just rely on Dr. Rosen. He's only one person. I also have 5 other group mates who can offer me their insight and their advice. Now, they don't have the training that Dr. Rosen has, but the advantage of them is outside of session, I can go to coffee with them. I can go over to their house when I've been broken up with, and I can cry into their throw pillows. And that was the beginning of really opening myself up even beyond just a 90-minute session.
I wonder if you had experience with the more traditional, you know, one-on-one, laying on a couch sort of therapy, and if you could compare the two, or have you only done the sort of group project?
I had done a little bit of individual therapy in high school, and that didn't work because I wasn't honest. I went in there thinking, well, I'm going to show this therapist how functional and smart and lively I am. And I was 16, and that it doesn't work if you're not going to be honest. And I wasn't. And so that didn't work. And then I had a little bit in law school before I found Dr. Rosen, and I felt so many. First of all, I found it sort of boring. Like it was all, I was the only engine in the relationship because the therapist didn't say much, and I was kind of bored. And I also found that I kind of wanted to perform, and I wanted to take care of the therapist, and it was harder to just be my authentic self. So when I land in group and there's these five other people there, I can't hide from all five of them and the therapist. Like my true self came out by doing relationships in real time with other witnesses. And I found for me, the dynamism was fun and it was entertaining and it was so stimulating that when I went back to individual a couple times, sometimes I would go see Dr. Rosen individually and I'd be like, this is so boring. I can't wait to go back to group.
Listeners, if you're just tuning in, this is the 21st. We're speaking with Christy Tate, who is a Chicago-based writer. Her new memoir, her debut memoir, is called Group: How One Therapist and a Circle of Strangers Saved My Life. And the writing in this book is it's remarkably transparent and raw, right? I mean, you reveal some very vulnerable aspects of yourself about binge eating apples and smashing dishes after sexual rejection, for example.
Yes.
I wonder, what is it like presenting such an open and self-reflective part of yourself for the whole world to read?
Yeah, that's a good question. And I get that all the time. And I really think that the answer comes back to the work I did in group, which really convinced me that shame is a bigger problem than disclosure. And so what I've discovered since people have been discovering my book and some of the early readers and when I would workshop it, the places in the book where they resonated the most was where I was the most graphic or detailed. And that's when for them the story came alive. And so as I learned in therapy, being fairly specific and detailed about whatever was troubling me, those same principles translate on the page. And I'd already worked through everything in the book I've already worked through, so there's very little shame about it.
The conversation we've been having makes it sound very serious, and certainly there are serious aspects, but there's humor too, right? Can you talk about the role of humor, when dealing with these very serious personal issues for you?
Sure. That's one of the very first gifts I got in group, which was I would come in thinking, oh my God, you guys aren't going to believe what I did. And I would talk about, last night I ate six apples, which is that's bizarre, but it's not crazy. It's not beyond the pale. And somebody would laugh good-naturedly and crack a joke about it. And this was like my long-held secret. And somebody was like laughing, like it's not that big of a deal. And so what I found in the process of therapy in group was these people that I've shared the circle with are smart, they're dynamic, they're invested in their mental health, and they're funny. And we've been together a long time. So we have a lot of like inside jokes and banter, and we can all laugh about, for in my case, we can laugh about some of the men I dated, some of the decisions I made that didn't go well against their advice. And so I think humor is important when dealing with mental health issues are so dark. It's so scary to go into trauma, but having company and being willing to laugh when the joke appears or to bring some kind of levity both to the writing of the story and the living of the story, it's the only way I could have survived the kind of deep trauma work required.
Is group therapy a journey with an end, or is it a process like so much of therapy that's ongoing, right? Mental health is something people often have to work on their entire lives. Can you talk about that journey aspect of it?
I think that the journey of mental health is as individual as the people who need the work. And for some people, I have a lot of people in my life, they've come to Dr. Rosen, I've shared the circle with them, and they have moved on. And we've stayed close, and I've watched them pursue other therapies, or just sometimes people want to spend time without therapy, which I completely respect. For me personally, what I like about working with Dr. Rosen and going to group therapy is there is an opportunity to stay. And what I like about that is I came into group with longings and desperate for relationships. And now I have the relationships. I had more than I dreamed of, but I keep going back because I found I still need support. I still want company and levity and people to help me make the decisions I have to make now and reach for the things I want in my life that I don't have, even though they're very different. And I'm certainly not on the edge. But as I raise my children, as I face a pandemic, as I help aging parents, I still want my group. I still want my therapist. So my journey is ongoing, but I don't think there's any one size fits all.
You know, for some people, there is still a sort of a stigma to therapy. And so I wonder, what do you hope that readers will gain from reading your memoir?
I certainly hope that they gain an understanding that there's more tools in the therapeutic toolbox than they maybe knew about. So now group is something, for anybody who didn't know about it, now they know that that is a process that has worked at least for me. And also I hope that people will sort of have an appreciation for the fact that therapy, we wait many, the stigma I think comes from, we wait to go to therapy in this country till there's a crisis, and I didn't go till I was on the brink. And I wish that people would sort of take an interest in their mental health when there's low grade issues or building issues and prevent this sort of like only emergency therapy. I think that's a disservice. That's something in our culture that doesn't serve people.
You just heard our conversation with Chicago-based writer Christy Tate about her new memoir, Group, How One Therapist and a Circle of Strangers Saved My Life. We spoke with her back in October when the book was first published. And listeners, if you or someone you know is in need of help, you can get in touch with the National Crisis Text Line, which provides free and confidential crisis intervention. Just text the word HELLO to 741-741. That's HELLO to 741-741. You're listening to The 21st. We'll be back after a short break. This is The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. This week and next on the show, we're re-airing some of our favorite conversations from this year. Today, we're hearing from writers. Back in September, former NPR foreign correspondent Eric Weiner came on The 21st to discuss his new book, reflecting on the wisdom of some old thinkers, including Socrates, Thoreau, and Nietzsche. Maybe you avoided Philosophy 101 in high school or college, but these challenging times are a great opportunity to revisit history's greatest thinkers. To do so, Weiner went on a pilgrimage to places like Athens, Delhi, and even Coney Island, traveling by train and by foot, literally following in the footsteps of some of our greatest philosophers. The book is The Socrates Express, In Search of Life Lessons from Dead Philosophers. Here now is my interview with Eric Weiner. Eric, I want to begin, you know, by taking the Socrates Express stop by stop, so to speak, right? But first, in the introduction, the first thing you write about is the difference between information, knowledge, and wisdom. Can you talk about that? Why should we be seeking wisdom?
Right, because I think we often confuse those three, and we live in an information age, and we tend to think that if we have a problem, it can be solved by greater information or knowledge. And really, I don't think that's true. With our current situation with the pandemic, it's not really a lack of information and knowledge that's preventing us from getting over the hump, but a lack of wisdom. So information is really a jumble of data bytes, if you will. Knowledge is a more organized jumble, but wisdom is what you do with it, right? It's been said that knowledge is knowing that a tomato is a fruit. Wisdom is not putting it in a fruit salad.
I want to ask why in particular ancient wisdom, right? I mean, you look at the self-help section of the bookstore, there's new titles every month. What is the advantage of going back to, you know, millennia in some cases to find wisdom?
Well, because we don't want to go back to the ancient Greeks for, say, pharmacology, right? That we've made great advances. But when it comes to wisdom, we're really much closer to the ancients than we think. I mean, they exalted and suffered and had headaches for all the same reasons that we do. And as I like to say, you know, knowledge has an expiration date, but wisdom doesn't. Wisdom is portable. It transcends space and time. And I should add that a lot of these ancient philosophers and not so ancient ones lived through pandemics really much worse than ours. I mean, they've been there, whether it was Socrates in Athens or Montaigne in southern France during the Black Death. So we'd be silly not to listen to them.
Yeah, and if I could just be self-indulgent for a moment and share my own story. There was a number of years ago, I was introduced to Seneca and his Letters from a Stoic. And I was struck, I was writing a newspaper column at the time, and there was like good advice for the information age, right? He had this one line about, while everyone around me was hurrying thus from all directions to the waterfront, I found a great deal of pleasure in refusing to bestir myself. This was basically right. Mail call, right? And he's sort of bragging that he turned off notifications on his phone, you know, the first right. century
and
version
the waterfront
of that.
Is the internet, basically, right?
Yeah, exactly.
And I mean, it's interesting that you mentioned Seneca, who is a Stoic, because I think Stoicism is, in particular, one of the ancient philosophies that's particularly helpful during times like these. Stoicism is really a philosophy for tough times, because what it teaches us is that we cannot control events. They are outside of our control. But what we can control is our reaction to them. And that may seem obvious, but we don't often live that way. We act like there's only one possible reaction to a crisis, and that is, you know, to pull our hair out and to drink too much and all those things. And the Stoics say, wait a second. It's actually up to you how you respond emotionally inside to these events.
Eric, I want to talk about the structure of your book, right? It's based on train travel to these places where these philosophers spent a lot of time in their lives, places of significance for them if they didn't live there. Athens for Socrates, Delhi for Gandhi, etc. Why do you like to travel by train? Why is that important?
I can think on a train, and I can't think on an airplane, no matter what class of service. At 30,000 feet, maybe it's a thin air, maybe, I don't know what it is. And I can't think on a bus either, but I can think on a train, and I'm not alone in this regard. Many great ideas have been birthed on trains, including Harry Potter. J.K. Rowling was on a delayed British rail train when she dreamed up the idea of the boy wizard. So there's something about train travel that lends itself to contemplation. For the obvious thing is that it's slower, that you've slowed down. And a lot of philosophy, the kind of practical philosophy I'm speaking of, the first step is really to slow down, to pause, and to take your time. And we're so busy rushing around trying to answer questions, solve problems. We don't sit and experience really profound questions about, you know, what it means to lead a good life, to be a good person, or just to be happy. You know, we don't often stop and pause. And on a train, you're moving slowly and you have time to think.
Okay, well, let's take a couple of stops on your train journey here.
Sure.
The first, it begins with mornings, how to get out of bed, like Marcus Aurelius. I think many of us could use advice on this some days. You know, what can you or Marcus Aurelius,
right.
I guess.
Right. So Marcus Aurelius was a Roman emperor, right? Like, extremely powerful man who ruled over like a quarter of the planet's population at the time, and he was a Stoic, and yet he had trouble getting out of bed. And when I heard about this, I thought, well, here's someone I can relate to, because I also have trouble getting out of bed. And so in his thin little book called Meditations, which I highly recommend, he writes about lots of subjects, but he writes about this wrestling with this notion of, you know, it's so warm under the covers and it's so bad out there. Why should I get out of bed? And ultimately, he decides it's his sense of duty. And not as a Roman or as a philosopher, but as a human being to help others. That's why he gets out of bed. And I think that's what gets a lot of us out of bed. It's not to find pleasure or to achieve our goals. It's, you know, because the kids need to be have breakfast, or the dog needs to be fed, or whatever it is. It's other sentient beings. And that's sort of the takeaway from that chapter.
You know, and I want to sort of, you know, the pandemic has presented so many challenges to us. And so I want to, you know, kind of jump through a few of the other stops on your train, not necessarily in a rush, but pick a few philosophers that you write about and, you know, what you think we can learn, you know, given in our current context from what they had to say. So let's start with Thoreau. How can we see or maybe shift our perspective like Thoreau?
Right. So Thoreau is, you know, best known for his experiment in isolation at Walden Pond. He really wasn't so isolated, but that's another story. But really, I think what he's about is seeing, about seeing more everyday beauty. And Thoreau would, you know, he would change his perspective. He would look at, say, Walden Pond up in Concord, Massachusetts, you know, from a hilltop, and then he'd look at it from a rowboat on the surface. He'd dive underwater. He'd even peer between his legs, sort of bend over and look at the pond upside down. And the point of all this was really to notice the everyday beauty that we often miss. I mean, as Thoreau says in his journals, you know, with the right mindset, every drop in a rainstorm is a rainbow. And we tend to rush through life and not see the beauty that's right before us, before our very eyes. And that's one of the great lessons of Thoreau, is slowing down, yes, but also, you know, changing your perspective, looking at what's before you every day from 10 or 20 degrees off center and seeing something today that you didn't see yesterday.
And part of this journey for you is on foot, right? I mean, train slows you down from an airplane, and walking slows you down from a train. And, right. And whether you're following Gandhi, and I want to come back to Gandhi in a minute, but Gandhi or Rousseau, how does one's environment, you know, how does walking through an environment affect the way you see it?
Well, walking is really conducive to philosophy and thinking. And whether it was Thoreau in Concord or Rousseau in Europe, in France at the time, in Switzerland, a lot of these thinkers were great walkers, and that's not a coincidence. There's something about the act of walking that is both, it's contemplative and it's active at the same time. You're sort of in motion and at rest at the same time. And there's something about that combination, like train travel, that lends itself to thinking. And Jean-Jacques Rousseau, the Swiss philosopher in the 18th century, would walk 20 miles a day, think nothing of it. And he carried a deck of playing cards with him, and when an idea came to him, he would jot them down on the playing cards. I mean, many listeners may have experienced this themselves. They're stuck in some problem in their life or at work, and then they go for a nice long walk, and all of a sudden the solution appears. And I should add that walking is one thing that we can still do today, socially distanced and outdoors, and I think it's very therapeutic, especially now.
If you're just tuning in, this is the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. We're speaking with Eric Weiner, whose latest book is The Socrates Express. Mike in Champaign, welcome to the 21st. What's your question for Eric?
Hi there. Great book. I haven't read, but the title and your conversation has encouraged me to do that. I'm wondering if you included folks who might be dismissed in some way as humorists, other than just philosophers like Will Rogers and Mark Twain, who I think hold a wealth of wisdom for us. I'll hang up and listen to your answer. Thank you very much for the program.
All right. Thanks for calling in, Mike. So, Eric, do the noted philosophers, Rogers or Twain?
No Will Rogers or Mark Twain, but the caller makes an interesting point about humor. There is this connection between philosophy and humor. You know, I think it was William James who said that, you know, humor is common sense dancing. And I think there's something to that. And Steve Martin, the comedian, not many people know this, but he majored in philosophy as an undergrad. And he famously said, if you major in any other subject, you forget it all the moment you graduate. But if you major in philosophy, you retain just enough to mess you up for the rest of your life. Which is sadly the impression many people have of philosophy. They don't often think of it as practical or fun, but as I discovered, it's both of those things.
How did you pick which philosophers you were going to include?
Well, I picked the ones, Brian, that spoke to me, the ones who were red-blooded, fully animated human beings in all the good and bad ways. I mean, these were flawed individuals. Rousseau had this strange habit of exposing his backside in public to strangers. And don't get me started on Nietzsche. And he was a strange dude. They were all, these men and women, were all odd in different ways and flawed, but they were heroic. I mean, they really wrestled with life's big ideas. And I also, you know, I wanted a smattering of, I would say, a representation from the ages, from ancient Athens, you know, Socrates in 5th century BC, all the way up to Simone de Beauvoir in 20th century Paris, and Western and non-Western thinkers like Gandhi and Confucius. The West has no monopoly on wisdom, that's for sure.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned Gandhi, because you lived, as I understand it, in India for years as an NPR correspondent. One of the chapters in your book is How to Fight Like Gandhi. Obviously, we're seeing a lot of protests in the United States now against police brutality, for racial justice. Do you see lessons in Satyagraha for what's happening today?
Absolutely. Satyagraha means literally soul force, and it was, the term was invented by Gandhi to define what he saw as a very courageous form of resistance, which is nonviolent resistance. And the big misunderstanding about Gandhi is that he was a pacifist. He wasn't. He hated the term. He hated anything that reeked of pacifism. He was very active. He would get into the face of his opponent, but completely nonviolently. John Lewis's term about getting into good trouble, necessary trouble, that's pure Gandhian, and it's not a coincidence. John Lewis studied Gandhi, traveled to India, as did Martin Luther King Jr. And Gandhi was a stickler for discipline among the ranks of his satyagrahis, the nonviolent resistors. And he would be known, he would shut down a protest if there was even an inkling of violence among, you know, could be thousands and thousands of protesters, even an inkling of violence, he would shut it down, I think for two reasons. One was the moral reason. He thought that you had to essentially rise above the people you were and try to convert the people you were protesting against. And so the moral imperative was to do that nonviolently, but also strategically, he knew, as we're seeing today in the news, that if there's a little bit of violence in an otherwise nonviolent protest, that becomes the news and that takes away from your message.
We've been hearing a lot about empathy and this idea of, you know, understanding what our fellow Americans are going through. This is obviously a tense and divided time politically. Another stop on your train, another chapter in your book is being kind like Confucius. Are there lessons there for Americans in 2020?
Yes, there is. Confucius thought that kindness, he didn't invent kindness, of course, but he was the first philosopher to talk about kindness as sort of a governing strategy. He lived during a very violent time of the warring states in China, and he thought that a good ruler used kindness, and that was more effective at keeping control, actually, over a population and maintaining your authority as a governing person. And on a more practical, everyday level, he thought that we need essentially kindness rituals. Confucius was big on ritual, and he thought that ritual is basically the container that holds our kindness. And, you know, this is why there's a greeting card section in stores, and we don't have to write them ourselves, that there's the ritual of sending the card and the place to go to get them. And we sort of, I think, kind societies have lots of these containers, if you know what I mean. They have lots of ways of expressing kindness. The Japanese are famously polite, which may or may not overlap with kindness, but there are lots of rituals to dip into. And it's during times of crisis like now, and you want to be kind and you don't know what to do, that it's nice to have these sort of preset rituals to turn to.
We just heard my conversation with Eric Weiner, former NPR foreign correspondent and author of the best-selling book, The Geography of Bliss. His latest book is The Socrates Express, In Search of Life Lessons from Dead Philosophers. I spoke with him on the 21st, back in September. Coming up after the break, another author interview, this time with someone who's traveled a little closer to home, learning about how some small Illinois towns ended up with big names. This is The 21st. Stay with us. This is The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. Earlier this month, our state celebrated its 202nd birthday. On December 3rd, 1818, Illinois became the 21st state. Hence the name of our show, The 21st. Now you know. All this week, we're revisiting some of our favorite conversations from the year, and today is Book Day. To commemorate 2 centuries and 2 years of Illinois statehood, we were joined by Laurent Pernot. He's a former reporter and public affairs consultant and now works as a college administrator in Chicago. He first came to Illinois as a foreign exchange student from France and now calls the state home. His forthcoming book is There and Here, Small Illinois Towns with Big Names. I started by asking his reaction the first time he heard about the Illinois town called Paris. Laurent, you're originally from France, have lived in Illinois for several decades. I wonder when you first heard about Paris, Illinois, or what we call Paris, Illinois, what was your reaction to that town name?
It was a funny moment. Actually, someone told me, oh, you're from France. I'm from Paris. So I started speaking French to them. And they said, no, Paris, Illinois. I said, wait, there's a Paris, Illinois?
Oh, and come that's on. Really that, that, this is a real story?
Yes. This was a teacher. In a high school where I was an exchange student. Wow. And so, you know, I guess that planted the seed. You know, the curiosity of all these wonderfully named towns and what was behind them. And, you know, many of them are rooted in for most of them, European cities and countries. But, you know, they're uniquely Illinois and uniquely American. And just most of them are just so charming and a delight to discover.
There are so many Illinois towns with international names, often pronounced differently. I think of Vienna, we pronounce it Vienna. San Jose is San Joe's. Is this something that's unique to Illinois in your experience?
I think it's uniquely American, but I think a lot of people make fun of that. And I think it's wonderful that we've adopted these names and made them our own. But I, you know, I once did ask for directions to Vienna, and people looked at me blankly to realize I was looking for Vienna. So these are things you have to learn. But you know, a lot of the towns that really were founded by people from those countries tend to have kept the pronunciation. And a lot of towns that were founded more out of hope for the future or inspiration by bigger names, a lot of the little Egypts in towns in southern Illinois, like Cairo, Thebes. Some of those names of pronunciation evolved. That's because there wasn't a culture from that country to kind of keep the name pronounced the way it was in the old country.
You write in your book that there's a depiction of Illinois as cornfields and red barns, and our state does have that, and there is beauty there. But once you venture off the interstate in a lot of places, you see a lot more. And I wonder if you can talk about some of those surprising places that you've found in Illinois.
Yes. You know, the interstate by design stays away from towns, right? So all people see maybe is the sign. But, you know, when you take the ferry from Grafton to Brussels, Illinois, and get into this hilly country, you really feel like the ferry has transported you in time, in a place where, you know, most of the structures are actually historical designations. You know, Norway, Illinois is really the Ellis Island of Norwegians. It's not just named after Norway. Thousands and thousands of Norwegian immigrants came through Norway, and probably many of the Norwegians across the Midwest had their ancestors come through Norway, Illinois. And to this day, there is monuments, one dedicated by the King of Norway. That's how important it was in the history of the country and the immigration from the country. So there's story after story, Geneva, Illinois, Ottawa, Illinois, story after story of those moments.
We're speaking with Laurent Pernot. He's a former reporter and public affairs consultant, now works as a college administrator in Chicago. His new book is called There and Here, Small Illinois Towns with Big Names. I understand this was quite a long time in the making. You talked about the seed of curiosity being planted when you were in high school, but even the process of researching and visiting a lot of these places, how did that come about?
Well, 10 years of crisscrossing the state and realizing there were more towns. You know, you start with the obvious ones. You start with the Paris and the Cairos, and then you realize there's the Cubas and Havana, and which also is not pronounced like its namesake. There is the Chinese Triangle, as I like to call it, Canton, Pekin, and Shanghai City. It becomes almost endless. And I have to say, there's a couple small towns that did not make the book, but I think just about everyone is there. For a while, I thought I would also go for towns named after famous people, but you have to draw the line somewhere. It's interesting, Ryan, you mentioned the cornfields have their own beauty. Savoy, Illinois, which is just outside Champaign, was actually named after the region in Europe and actually visited, named after the royalty from Savoy. The Count of Savoy, who was visiting Illinois and visited with Abraham Lincoln in D.C., actually wrote at length about just how beautiful the steppe-like cornfields and farms were in Illinois. So a lot of the visitors actually embrace both the towns they see. Charles Dickens fell in love with Lebanon, Illinois, and a lot of the people embrace both the towns and the more natural aspects of the state too.
And I think I've read that Champaign, Illinois itself was, I guess it was named after Champaign County, Ohio, but that in turn was named for the French province of Champaign. It's all over the place.
Where the spelling had been so changed that it bore little resemblance, but you point to an important thing is a lot of towns like Norway, Illinois, for instance, we're named for the European town directly. A lot of towns like Paris, like Versailles, were named that way because of places in Kentucky or Ohio. And so you have a place out east that is named for the European country or the European city. People come to Illinois from Kentucky, for instance, and name it for their town or a town near where they were in Kentucky. And that's how we end up, for instance, with Versailles.
I don't want to let it go. A moment ago, you mentioned Charles Dickens fell in love with Lebanon. What is the story there?
He was here in America, kind of doing what people do today, but it was a lot harder then. He was researching a book. He stayed at a hotel that I believe is called the Mermaid Inn in Lebanon, Illinois. And, you know, he said it was on par with some of the nicer establishments he might have stayed at in England. Now, on the other side, he hated the countryside around there, but he really liked the town. And they still have Dickens days in Lebanon every year.
Fascinating. You also write about Illinois' capital cities. And it obviously the current capital is Springfield. But your book actually lists six capitals of Illinois. Which one is the first?
So Cahokia Mounds, which a lot of people know because it was it's the only site in the Midwest to be a UNESCO World Heritage Site, was the site of the largest pre-Columbian civilization, so the largest indigenous civilization in North America.
Before the arrival of Europeans.
and actually started to be on a decline before then, but really was the site of the transition of power and the transition of land ownership. A lot of Europeans, especially then the French, came to that part of the world and at first befriended the indigenous people and eventually pushed them aside. And eventually we know there was a lot of violence on both sides as the indigenous people tried to stake claim to their culture and their land. And, you know, a lot of violence ensued, but that's the history of Cahokia Mounds, which is also undone, you know, by disease as well as by violence. And then the French established Fort de Chartres here, which was the capital of Upper Louisiana and really the capital of French power in the Midwest for decades on end until the English defeated the French, and then the Americans took over early in the 19th century. So Southern Illinois was not only the power center for the state, it was the power center for much of the Midwest long before Chicago even was a thing and even had a name. And so what's important too is, you know, what I call Illinois Atlantis, Kaskaskia, which was the first official capital of the state, is also in Southern Illinois, was swallowed up by the Mississippi, but it has amazing vestiges. We travel out east to see some historical towns, and some of them are right here in our own state. We have to mention though that the French didn't just bring trappers and some finer things to the area, they brought slavery. And the English after them and the Americans after them embraced slavery to the point where the first governors of the state and the first lieutenant governor of the state owned slaves. And that's something that we often don't pay attention to in a place called the Land of Lincoln.
Absolutely. We actually had a conversation earlier this year with a Southern Illinois teacher who has written a book about slavery in Southern Illinois. We're running out of time here, but you write in your that a lot of these places in your book are disappearing. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think I was, the pictures from Cairo were a few years back. Several of the buildings have been razed. Cairo is a good microcosm of the state and the country, I think. There's grandeur and there's beauty and there's very ornate buildings, beautifully restored and you know, that speak of wealth. And then there's really unspeakable desolation and decay. There is a farm in the book in Hampshire that it's gone. It's being replaced by what looks like to be a subdivision. The Mississippi is again jumping its bed in Southern Illinois. There was a wonderfully ornate house in Lyons across the street from what is a castle tower in Lyons, Illinois, which is in the book. But the house across the street was looked like a castle too. It looked a little Austrian to me, actually not French, but you know, it burned down. We have a lot of wonderful vestiges in the state, and I think we need to focus as a state on preserving as much of it as possible.
Laurent Pernault is the author of a new book called There and Here, Small Illinois Towns with Big Names. If people want to find it, you have a website set up. Can you give the address there where people can go and place an order?
Sure. The ebook is on Google Books and on Amazon, though I have to say Google Books is a lot kinder to authors than Amazon. So if you have a choice, shop there. And then I have a link to all various books and this on the website, laurentpernault.com. Where you can, laurentpernautbooks.com, where you can also order their hard copy book.
Okay. And we will have a link to that on our own website, 21stshow.org, and we will tweet that out at 21st as well. Laurent Pernault, thank you so much for being on with us today.
Ryan, thanks for having me again. Happy birthday, Illinois.
That is all the time we have for today. Coming up tomorrow, some of our favorite arts and entertainment interviews from this year, including new Illinois Poet Laureate Angela Jackson, actress, comedian, and Northern Illinois University alumna Mary Holland, who co-wrote the Christmas movie Happiest Season, and also Andrew T., comedian and host of a podcast called Yo, Is This Racist? One more thing. As I said earlier, our interview with Laurent Pernault was on Statehood Day, and we ended our broadcast with our Illinois State song called Illinois. This version was released earlier this year by the University of Illinois School of Music. Owing to the pandemic, members of the UI Women's Glee Club and the Varsity Men's Glee Club recorded their parts individually, and U of I audio engineers assembled the finished recording. Andrea Solia conducted. The soloist is Barrington Coleman.
By thy rivers gently flowing, Illinois, Illinois. By thy prairies verdant growing, Illinois, Illinois. Comes an echo on the breeze, rustling through the leafy trees, and its mellow tones are these, Illinois, Illinois, and its mellow tones are these, Illinois.
Illinois.
The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey. Talk to you tomorrow.